Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
How you doing? And welcome to the show. We are jam-packed this week as we speak with food and travel editor of the Washington Post, Joe Yonan, on his new book called Serve Yourself, which promotes the art of cooking for one. We also speak with renowned DJ Stéphane Grandin on his illustrious career spinning at clubs and events all around the world. Gina Lee is here with the Love Zone, and Mummy Alexander stops by to give you tips on how to prepare your lawn for the summer months. Lots to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
A lot of times the single life gets a bad rap. People tell you it must be so hard, you know, to go to a movie by yourself, a hockey game, or even out to a restaurant because you're all alone. Well, one man is here to tell you that it's not all doom and gloom, especially when it comes to cooking for one. Joe Yonan is the food and travel editor at the Washington Post, and he's also written a brand new book called Serve Yourself, Nightly Adventures in Cooking for One, a book that celebrates cooking and eating solo. Joe, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks, Kelly. Glad to be here.
First of all, Joe, can you please tell us how you became the food and travel editor at the Washington Post? Because that sounds like a pretty awesome career.
Yeah, I love it. They're kind of the best fields you can possibly imagine, right?
Exactly.
I have worked in newspapers since I was 15 and sort of came up through community newspapers, editing small newspapers, and then worked my way kind of up and around, and was working at the Boston Globe when I sort of had a bit of a career crisis about news and wanted to make a change and thought about it and realized pretty quickly that my favorite stories had been about food and my favorite interviews had been with chefs. And I've always loved to cook since I was a kid. So I ended up going to culinary school and sort of veering my career in that direction. So started writing about food as much as I could, and then ended up writing about food full-time for the Boston Globe and editing the travel section there at one point, and then came down to the Post almost five years ago now to edit the food section.
I think for a lot of us listening, I think, you know, some people have these fantasy ideas that it's just a fun job, but you do have a lot of work to do, right, Joe?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's fun work, but it's still work. You know, when I am testing recipes or when I'm going on a trip to research a travel story, which I don't get to do nearly as much as my writers do, it's still work. You know, you're not completely turned off and relaxed the way you would be if you weren't working, but it's incredibly fun, stimulating work.
And now if we turn to the book, why did you decide to write the book Serve Yourself? What's the philosophy behind it?
Well, I've been writing a column for the Post for a little while, a monthly column on Cooking for One. And I just started to realize more and more that I had very passionate feelings about this idea that just because you're single doesn't mean you should be forced to eat takeout all the time, and that single people deserve an interesting, varied diet, and that it can be really fun to learn how to cook for yourself. You know, I hear way too many people whenever I ask single cooks if they cook for themselves or what they make for themselves, you know, they always tend to use one of the words bother or trouble.
Right.
You know, why would I go to the trouble if it's just me? Why would I bother if it's just me? And I always think, well, why wouldn't you? Because you're more important than anybody. And so I just realized that I had a lot to say about it and wanted to sort of put it together in a more complete package.
Was it difficult to come up with a working model for a cookbook? Because, you know, everywhere you turn, recipes are always focused on two or more people.
Right. The standard recipe size, recipe yield is 4. So, yeah, I had to develop a lot. Well, I developed all the recipes, of course, and I based a lot of them on things that I already do. So those were easier, although, of course, I, you know, tried to make them really fantastic and even better than the types of things that I would necessarily do because I want people to sort of get really fired up about this idea. And then I downscaled some of my favorite recipes that I've worked with over the years, too. And that's super fun to do.
And was it difficult to come up with all the recipes, Joe? Like, or like you said, that they were sort of in your repertoire, some of them.
You know, the hardest thing, honestly, was remembering what I've done when I've made things that I really like. Because, like a lot of sort of improvisational cooks, and I do, you know, improv a lot when I'm in the kitchen, you know, I don't necessarily write things down normally. So the hardest thing, honestly, was just remembering sort of what I did when things turned out well, and then getting in the habit when I was working on the book of writing everything down. But other than that, it was, I mean, it's definitely a lot of work, but, you know, it's fun. It's really fun. I love being in the kitchen, so.
Joining us on the show right now is food and travel editor at the Washington Post and author of the book Serve Yourself, Joe Yonan. Check him out, www.joeyonan.com. Joe, what kinds of recipes can we look forward to in the book? So do they, you know, encompass a wide variety of cooking styles?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to cook pretty globally. So I'm from West Texas, so there are a lot of Southwestern flavors that show up in the book. I have a taco chapter in the book because I'm sort of obsessed with tacos. And I also, I tend to think, anytime I try something interesting, I tend to think, huh, what would that be like in a taco or as a taco?
That's awesome.
But I also have a pizza chapter because I'm also sort of obsessed with pizza. A sandwich chapter. I love eggs, and I think eggs are an incredibly useful, versatile thing for single cooks to have around. So I have an egg chapter. I even have a dessert chapter, believe it or not.
Wow, that sounds yummy. And I understand that the book also offers shopping and storage tips for the single chef.
Yes, because I don't know when the last time was that you tried to buy some celery, but celery is one of those things that is notoriously difficult to buy in small quantities. So I give people some tips such as if you're looking for things like celery that you can only find in huge bunches, look to see if the supermarket might possibly have a salad bar because they may have chopped or pieces of celery at the salad bar that you can buy by the pound. I suggest that people look for smaller versions. It sounds silly and kind of obvious, but to look for smaller versions of things that they like to buy. So I'm a big fan of shallots instead of onions, for instance. They're like small onions. They're milder. They're more, I think their flavor is more interesting too. But more importantly, for the single cooking experience, they're just easier to manage. You know, Brussels sprouts are the single person's cabbage, for instance.
Okay.
So I give some suggestions for that, but some storage tips too. Yeah.
And, you know, Joe, I wanted to ask you, because you've been doing this for a long time, what do you say to someone who is single and doesn't want to take the time to really create, you know, this wonderful meal for themselves to eat by themselves? Is it like a mental shift that they need to go through in their mind to sort of get over the taboo of it, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that I like to talk about that I think is a really helpful way to think about this is, you know, cooking for yourself can be very freeing. You know, if you like to cook at all, and if you like to, you know, throw dinner parties, and I love to throw dinner parties, there's some anxiety involved in throwing a dinner party, right? Like, there's a little performance anxiety. You want to make sure you're going to make something that's going to turn out well. You know, I have a friend who never makes anything for a dinner party that he hasn't done a dry run of. Which is the rule that a lot of really accomplished cooks have, you know, never try out a recipe on a crowd, right? But when you're cooking for yourself, all that kind of goes out the window because you have nobody else's palate or dietary restrictions or quirky preferences or allergies or appetites to take into consideration but your own. So you can kind of do whatever you want and follow your hankerings to whatever end they may lead you. And there's no judgment. There's nobody there to say you did something right or did something wrong. The worst thing that's going to happen, if you try something new, try something different, experiment, the worst thing that's going to happen is that it's going to turn out inedible, and so you just don't eat it. Now, I don't think any of my recipes in the book obviously will lead you to something inedible. I think they're really great, but, you know, I'm talking about getting in this mindset of feeling like you can be free and experiment in the kitchen, which I think is easier to do when you're cooking for yourself than it is when you're cooking for other people.
And something I just wanted you to expand on, if it's okay, Joe, because I thought it was very fascinating when I was reading some information off your website, and it really struck me because, you know, I'd been alone for so many years, and like you said, a lot of people don't want to take the time or they don't want to bother. But the fact that you just sort of said this one statement that I read, which went something along the lines of, who needs to take better care of yourself than you?
Right. No, absolutely. You know what I've been sort of thinking about, Kelly, I've been struck by this analogy recently. The last time I was flying, they were doing the safety demonstration. And, you know, they get to that point where they say, in the event of a sudden change in cabin pressure, masks will drop from the ceiling, take the mask, do the rubber band, like that whole rigmarole. But they also always say, secure your own mask before you help someone else.
Right.
And it struck me that that's really analogous to what I'm talking about. You know, you need to be able to take care of yourself. And I think it's important for people to get to a point where they're able to nourish themselves without needing to depend on anyone else. And only then, I think, are you able to be someone who can provide for other people. I mean, I like to nourish myself so that I'm healthy. I want to be a good friend. I want to be a good boss. I want to be a good coworker. I want to be a good son, brother. You know, I also am single, and eventually I want to be a good partner to someone, to that right person, you know. But I think that if I don't learn how to take care of myself first, I'm not going to be in a good position to be any of those things.
And Joe, I was just wondering, too, if you could maybe expand on, you know, a lot of single people, and I think you mentioned it in the book or at least on your website, where, you know, people, when they're single, they either do the takeout thing or they go to fast food restaurants. And do you find that single people get into trouble when they do that?
Yeah, I think that if you want to be healthy, you know, you need to learn how to cook for yourself. Takeout, there are more and more healthy options in the restaurant business, and there are chain restaurants and fast food restaurants that are paying attention to nutritional values in food. But for the most part, if you are trying to cut down on your sodium or fat or calories or just portions, you know, there's really no better way to do it than to make the food yourself, because you have control over everything. If you are wanting to eat locally, you can shop locally and cook all the food locally. You don't have to quiz the waiter about, you know, where did you source this broccoli. If you make it yourself, you know where it came from because you bought it.
That's awesome. That's a fantastic way to think of things. And Joe, what's up next for you? Because I know that, you know, the book's out and you're a busy bee with all of that, but what can we look forward to from you in the future? Another book, hopefully?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, my publisher wants me to be thinking about one, so I'm mulling over some ideas, and I'm not sure which way I'm going to go, sort of see how things go with this book. I love developing these recipes. So we'll see. I mean, maybe it'll be just serve yourself seconds. Who knows?
Awesome. That's fantastic. And Joe, where can people get a copy of your book?
You know, I just love saying this so much. It's available wherever books are sold.
Oh, that's fantastic. Joe, thank you. Thank you so much for being on my show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
That's Joe Yonan, food and travel editor at The Washington Post and author of the book Serve Yourself. Again, check him out, joeyonan.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee. No one likes being the bad guy, but there are times when we have to own up to our misdeeds and apologize. Saying sorry when you're in the wrong is a real test of pride and humility. But for relationships to thrive, we have to be willing to admit our mistakes and to ask for forgiveness in order to forge ahead onto better pastures. It's easy to revert to the childish stance of, I'm not saying sorry until you say sorry, or to rely on the old passive-aggressive line, I'm sorry if you think I did something wrong. Drop all of that. If you really want to repair a relationship that's on the rocks, you have to leave your ego at the door and acknowledge your faults. So if you've done and or said something that has hurt your significant other and you sincerely want to apologize, here are a few tips on how to do it effectively. First, assess the situation. How bad is the fallout? Is your partner not talking to you at all? Are they open to communication? You'll need to decide the best way to reach out, whether it's by email, phone, or in person. While it's important to allow some time for both sides to cool off, don't wait too long to give your apology, or you'll be met with a much higher wall of resentment. Since you are the offender, you have to respect your partner's space and the pace they set for the interaction. You can't shove an apology down their ears if they're not ready to hear it yet. but you need to let them know that you'd like to speak to them in person if possible so that you can apologize. Saying the word sorry is not difficult. It's the circumstances that surround the reason for the apology that makes it challenging. Not only is it a potentially embarrassing exercise, but it can be painful as well, because apologizing requires both of you to relive the ugly incident that took place. That's why so many run from making apologies, or at best do half-hearted make-up favors that don't directly address what happened, but an apology is implied. So it's flowers, gifts, or just being extra nice and carrying on as if nothing happened, hoping your partner will take the hint and drop the issue. Now, gifts and niceties are, well, nice, but be careful not to have those serve as a substitute for saying sorry. Buying one's way out of an apology sets up an unhealthy pattern in a relationship and does nothing to solve the issue. If you want to get your partner a gift or do something romantic for them as a way to make up, save that for after the apology. So let's get to the bare bones of it. How do you give a good apology? Well, there's some main points you need to hit. First, be specific. Break down exactly what you did wrong, what you said, what you did, and then acknowledge the fact that it hurt your partner. Without offering any excuses, take ownership of your actions and claim responsibility for the role you played in the incident. Right away, you'd have accomplished about 80% of the challenge. Accepting responsibility is major, and your partner will appreciate that. You could almost end there, but we won't. There are a couple finishing touches that will put the issue to rest and your relationship back on track. After your detailed apology, include what I like to call a forward statement. Basically, state your intentions going forward from this point. Make a promise to not repeat the offense. And since you already listed every painful point, you both know exactly what it is. You can also ask for your partner's patience towards this end, as it may take you a few tries to correct your behavior. And finally, ask for forgiveness. You've laid it all on the line and put the power back in their hands. Again, this will test your pride, but if you love this person, it's worth it. Now, if your partner decides they are unable to forgive you, you have to accept that. An apology doesn't guarantee forgiveness. Sometimes the damage we've done is irreversible. The best you can do at that point is to forgive yourself, be at peace with the situation, and be proud of yourself for at least being brave enough to say, "I'm sorry."
Making you cry, I broke.
industry is no easy task, and that includes if you're behind the turntables as the DJ. Montreal native Stéphane Grondin has graced some of the premier clubs throughout the world, including Club Parking in Montreal, where he's now the resident DJ, Salvation in Miami, Trade in London, as well as the infamous Ministry of Sound, also in London. He's produced many of his own tracks, including the Juno-nominated Wake Up and the incredibly popular track Enjoy. And now he's going to be opening for the one and only Kylie Minogue when she comes to Montreal at the end of April. Stéphane, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hello, thank you very much.
Stéphane, can you tell us how you became a DJ? Was it something that you've wanted to do since childhood? Because I think, you know, this is quite the career to have.
It's actually, it came because of my father used to do weddings on his spare times during weekends. And when I was 13, he started to bring me in his, you know, in his gig and things like that. And he said, okay, do you want to mix two, three tracks? And then he started to show me how to read a dance floor. Okay, keep some hits for later. So from 13 and 14 and on, I've been doing that and nonstop till this day. So I've never actually thought about doing it, but it was a dream of mine. When I was young, I was hearing mixes on the radio, live mixes from a radio station, and I was like, how do they do that? How do they put two songs together? How do they make echoes, reverb?
Wow.
So I've been doing that for nonstop. So I've been really, really lucky because it's a tough business.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people think that, you know, being a DJ is just, you know, pure fun. But can you tell us maybe some of the experiences and challenges that you've gone through to get where you are today? You know, you mentioned that you had to sort of start at weddings. Did you do a lot of those? And did you have to do a lot of, like, house parties to get noticed to maybe get that first residency?
No, I didn't do house parties, but I've been, I started doing weddings, as I said, but also in Mont-Laurier, because I'm from Mont-Laurier. It's a town north of Montreal in the Laurentian. And they were doing every two Fridays, like two Fridays a month, they were doing like a dance for underage kids. So I started doing that, and it's there that a club saw me and heard me and said, okay, we want you to spin at our club. But I didn't have the age, so they had to build a DJ booth for
wow.
me. And then at 10 o'clock, the manager would come, and they would lock the door, and I would have a big window, and I would see, and I was not allowed to leave the DJ booth until 3:30. It started like that. So that was my, like, first experience. So my childhood, meaning not childhood, but when I was a teenager, I lost most of my friends because they couldn't come at the bar, and I was working at a bar. So my parents says, you know what, we're going to allow you to do that if you have good grades. But
okay.
So that was basically my stuff. So you had to put, like, I remember I had to put like a rock song and then a reggae and then a pop and then a dance or a house or a disco. So it was kind of hard to mix.
Yeah.
That was my school.
And then how did you go from that club, which was north of Montreal, how did you get down to the big city?
It was actually, I had to move here to go to school. To go to university, and also I went to Trebus to learn the ropes of, you know, MIDI computing and producing. And I was working still in Mont-Laurier every weekend, but I met a few people here, and then Pierre Vien, that used to own Sky, heard that I was spinning sometimes for a bar that was called Le Beat. It was mainly for a college and a university student in St. Hubert and St. Catherine. So I was just doing one night a week, and then Pierre said, do you want to work on Mondays? You know, I have Mondays. So I said, you know what, yes. You know, it's going to be my foot in Montreal, you know, my foot in the door. So I started every Monday, but after a month, he gave me the Fridays, and I stayed there for 6 years, I think, every Friday as a resident. So that was my step in the door for Montreal, and then on. It actually went really fast at one point because I met a lot of people, and it was back when a DJ was not even on the flyer.
Okay.
The name of the DJ was not on the flyer. So I came from that school. You know, sometimes I hear kids that want to be a DJ, and they want their name on a big flyer, and I was like, yeah, but that's not that's not the job, you know.
You have to earn your stripes.
Yeah, but also it's not for me. I came from, you know, back in the days, the music was more important than the DJ, and for me, it still is.
Okay. And who inspired you? Who inspired you, Stefan? Apart from your dad, to do what you do? Do you have other DJs that you've looked up to in the past?
Oh my God! Yes, yes, yes. The first producer, DJ producers that I've, you know, was Peter Rauffer, Danny Caniglia, Eric Copper. Eric Copper is the guy that did most, maybe 80% of all the 90s music. He was doing the keyboards for all these DJ like Peter Rauffer and Danny, Victor Calderon. Back in the days, was like the main keyboardist guys. So these guys, I started to follow from day one. So my dad was an inspiration, but it's more, my dad taught me the technical part, I would say.
What style of DJ do you consider yourself? What types of music or dance music do you like to play?
It took a long time for me to make a name for myself because of that. Because I'm not a DJ that only play one style. I like every style of music. So for example, like when I play at Stereo here in Montreal, it's a completely different set than I play once a month in New York at Splash. Why? Because of the first Splash in New York is more a commercial club. So because I have many sounds, you can't really put a sound on me. So it has helped me, but also it has worked against me over the years. But I play, I mean, I like to play from everything from house to tribal to some electro. I like vocals, I like non-vocals. So it could be hard to define. What I like, I usually play. But I will also be there for the people. Like, I mean, I'm not the type of DJ that work and if, you know, I get a request by email or on the spot and, you know, they ask me for a track, I would play because I'm here for the people that buys the tickets first to get in. So I'm not there to make a set for myself, but I'm there for the people that are dancing. So
that's amazing. Joining us on the show right now is DJ and producer Stefan Grandet. Make sure you check him out at www.stefangrandet.com. Also on Facebook, DJ Stefan Grandet. Stefan, you mentioned, you know, that you do all these different styles of music. Is it difficult for you to find music, to choose the music? Because there's so much out there, especially with the hot stuff that's out. How do you keep track of everything and determine what you're going to play and what you're not going to play?
Yes, that's a good question because for the past, I would say, a year and a half, 2 years, since Beatport.com has started to sell MP3s for DJs, all the record stores has closed. Like we used to go to InBeat Records on Saint Laurent on every Friday, and all the DJ would meet there, and we would get a selection of maybe 25 records, and then we would choose from this. But now, if you go online, Beatport or TrackSource or different online stores, you can have like maybe 500 tracks a week. So you have to be, you know, you have to do a little by little every day first. And then I always start with this. And also I get a lot of promo from a record label. So I have to send feedback. So right away when I write my feedback, I put aside things that, okay, this I think should go well. This, you know, could work well for me in New York or here. And then after, I have friends that I've met over the years, like Peter Rauffer is now a friend of mine, to name just him. And then he sends me, you know, his latest production, his remixes. And then, you know, I go from there. But it's like a full-time job in by itself.
That's what I figured.
So
it seems like
challenging.
There's a lot going on. And I don't even want to ask this, but I want to ask it anyway. Do you have favorite artists that you like to play?
No, actually, no. I don't. No, there's so many. I mean, I have a lot of favorites, but there's so many that, like, if from you artists, you say DJ, I like, you know, of course, all the names I gave you earlier, like Peter, Victor, Danny. Of course, when they have a new production, they're one of my favorite producers. I'm going to play it.
Okay.
But other than that, no. I have my filter is not is not that narrow.
Oh, that's
like,
awesome.
I'm very open, you know, because there's so much, as I said, so many new tracks a week online on by record company that sometimes the biggest tracks are from unknown artists, you know, so it's like...
You have to keep your mind open.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, you not only play clubs, but large-scale events, Stefan, like Black and Blue here in Montreal.
Yes.
Do you prefer to play events or you know, clubs, and is there a big difference?
Big difference. It's much harder. People are gonna sometimes are going to say, oh, it must be easier to play a bigger events. And I, for me, anyway, I find it harder because there are so many people. Sound is not always, you know, top-notch. So many different, you know, tastes also. If you take a crowd of 5,000 plus people, there's that many tastes, musical tastes in the room.
so there's a lot to cater to.
To please everyone.
Okay.
So I rather, for me, what I like more is playing a smaller scale, like stereo parking, or clubs that we don't have here, but like the Week in Brazil, I play there like maybe twice a year. It's 5,000, but it doesn't look like 5,000 people because you're almost on the dance floor. You can see the people because that's what's important when you're a DJ. You want to see the people. So when you do an event like Black and Blue and Blah Blah, you don't see anybody. You see a huge crowd, but you don't see the smiles. You don't see, you know. So and I like to have a connection with the people that are dancing.
Now, you're not only a DJ, Stefan, but a producer as well. Is being a producer for you a different type of creative outlet?
Oh, completely. Like you mentioned, like two tracks, but the two tracks that you mentioned were like the first two. But I did a lot of production for Star 69 Records, which is Peter Ruffer's label, and I did a few for Twisted Records also. And this is another thing. Because it's like not a day job, but it's like you create something or you're asked to remix something, to put your stamp on a track. But what it's good, it's because it's when you're a DJ at the same time, it helps you because you can take the track and try it out a few weekends and see what the crowd likes. You know, okay, the bass line doesn't work because the people, I don't know, stop dancing or you know, you feel it, you know. So that helps. But it's completely a different ball game because first you create something for a commercial purpose. So it's a label. So they're going to promote it, sell it, but it has nothing to do sometimes with what's going on in the underground world or commercial. So, but I like both.
I mean,
for me, it's my, I always say that I have two jobs, you know, weekdays I'm in my studio and weekends it's club. So.
Fantastic. Now I'm so excited to again announce that you are going to be opening up for Kylie Minogue when she comes to Montreal at the end of the month at the Bell Center. How excited were you to get this gig? Cause this just seems like such an amazing opportunity.
Oh my God. At first I couldn't believe it. I mean, when I started, the first thing that came to through my mind, it was like 26 years ago, almost, that when I started this journey, I wouldn't dream to have this type of gig because it's not a regular gig. I mean, you open for, you know, a big worldwide star. Plus, I have spun. You keep me hanging on, Locomotion. I mean, in the 80s, 90s, I have spun that when I started DJing. And now, to be opening for her, I mean, I still can put my head around this.
That's awesome. And Stefan, have they told you, like, how long do you have for your set for the Kylie Minogue show?
I think I'm going to have 1 hour.
Wow.
The doors open at 6:30, and I think she's going on at 7:30 or... I think it's around 7:30. So it's not a long set. I mean, but I'm as nervous, and the preparation's gonna be the same as if I would prepare for a 12-hour gig.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'm sure you want to have some surprises for the crowd as well. And do you think, like, for opening for Kylie, do you think you want to do more of this type of stuff?
Oh my! I mean, if there was there would be other opportunities for me, for sure. But I mean, since it's going to be the first time, I really don't know what to expect. Okay. And for me, it's the people that know me knows that I'm stage fright.
Okay.
Or how do you say that?
Yeah,
in
yeah,
English?
That's it. Yeah, stage fright.
Okay, I'm always the guy that don't want to be. You know, when I started in Mexico, I remember they had a stage. I would be lift off from the underground and then be on stage alone. I don't like that. So people that know me, that, you know me, that like DJ Boo, very quiet and let the music speak. To me, to be asked to be at the Bell Center, I'm going to be on stage. It's like also surreal.
This is going to be good like, for you. Maybe you'll get over your stage fright.
Maybe. Hope so.
That's fantastic.
But it's a great, I mean, it's great. I still can't believe it. And to have people like me, like call me and to ask me, you know, to talk about my craft and thing, it's like it's good opportunities, and I thank the universe for this.
And Stefan, what's next for you? Do you still see yourself in the music industry, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years? Will you move away from DJing and produce more? What do you think you're going to do?
I think it's going to be the path. I used to work like 5 days a week or 3 days a week in clubs, and I said to myself at one point, okay, when I get, you know, when I'm able to be, to, you know, to put some bread on my table, but to work only one night a week, it's going to be this. So I see myself in the future, see maybe 1-2 nights a month, maybe at one point, and still be in the studio. But I don't see myself, you know, you can't stop working. I mean, it's such a, we're so blessed to do this. You travel the world, you play music, you meet great people. Like, I mean, stop working at, 65 would be like, you know, what I'm going to do.
Okay, so you're going to work for a while.
But until people, you know, until people want me and the promoters hire me. Like, I mean, in this business, you don't really choose it. You do it, you love it, you do it for the people, for you, but you don't choose. At one point, it's maybe the people that's going to say, okay, this one is over, you know.
Okay, so one day you have to call it a day, but not now.
No, oh my God, no, I'm so young.
That's fantastic.
At least another 20 years.
Excellent. Stefan, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's DJ and producer Stefan Grandin. Again, make sure to check him out, www.stefangrandin.com. Also on Facebook, DJ Stefan Grandin.
Capture your need for sound.
From the man himself, this is Stefan Grandin's remix of Destiny's Child, Lose My Breath, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure when this lady joins us on the show, and it's been a little while since we've heard from the one and only Mummy Alexander. Mummy Alexander, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Sun's shining again, so I can't complain.
Very good, and thank you for joining us on the show. And, you know, normally we harass you.
I'm really glad to be here. It's always fun to talk with everyone and let them know how we're doing down on the farm.
Excellent. Well, this is why we wanted to talk to you today, because you know, normally we tease you and have a good time with things. And I think the last time you were on the show, we had you baking in the kitchen for Christmas. And now it's time to harass you about the profession that you do daily. And that is you're the head of sales for the farm for our company. And we deal in turf grass, which is lawns for people's houses and for golf courses and all that sort of good stuff. And you're in charge of sales, right, Mummy Alexander?
That's what I do.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I'm the dispatcher, too, for the trucks that go out with the loads of sod. Yeah.
I call you the Grand Poobah.
Oh, okay. This is a new one.
You have a lot to do with pretty much everything, Mom. But one of the things that you do is you actually talk to all the clients when it comes to their lawns and lawn care and all that sort of good stuff. And as we sort of march fully into spring and towards summer, I know a lot of people are very antsy about, you know, getting out on their lawns and stuff. So I have a bunch of questions for you, and particularly about actually marching on their lawns right now, because, you know, right now here in Montreal and across Canada, it's, you know, becoming spring and heading towards summer. But I think a lot of places are still soggy and wet from the winter and the snow. So what do you tell people who are getting out on their lawns and it's not dry yet?
Well, that's what happens. You see, they see all the fertilizer and everything out probably since the beginning of March, so they're so antsy to get going that they get going a little too quickly. The thing that's necessary is that the lawn is dry before they start raking. Otherwise, they pull out all the new little growth, the new little roots that are coming through. So main thing is that they wait till the lawn is almost dry before they start raking. I would say usually around the end of the last week of April or the beginning of May, then we start using the fertilizer, the seed and some lime.
And I have a question for you actually with regards to that. So you said you wait till the raking till the end of the month where it gets a bit drier. And then, so that's when you head out with the raking. And then what about people who have this idea that they should do some spring seeding?
It's fine to spring seed. I still recommend that they wait almost till the end of April, because, I mean, in Montreal it might be a week earlier, but or, you know, in the cities a week earlier, but if they wait and do it at the end of April, they can boost the seed with some fertilizer at the same time. So, you know, it might be even faster if they wait and, you know, the ground warms up. It won't hurt to throw down some seed, but if they rake all the roots out first, then they've got a problem.
And when it comes to throwing down the seed, is it that they have to put some ground and stuff on top of that? You don't just leave the seed fully on the grass,
no,
do you?
I call it, you make a sandwich.
Wow.
You start with a little bit of earth, brown earth preferably, or a mixture of brown and black and a little bit of sand, topsoil, depending if it's clay or if you're already on sand, you want to use good gardening earth. And then you put just a little down, about a quarter of an inch, and then you rake in the seed, doing it both ways, north, south, east, west, depending. And even if it's just a new, just, you know, a retouch-up, it's still better to do them both ways. And then cover with a little bit of ground. And then we add some fertilizer to activate the seed.
And how long, Mom, when you do this, when you throw down the seed and do the sandwich thing, are you supposed to stay off the lawn, like for a month?
No, because if it's just a touch-up, it's not going to really affect. I mean, they shouldn't be playing out there. Absolutely not. The kids should not be playing out there for at least, I would say, three, 4 weeks, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then when it comes to, you know, people who have lawns and they don't need to do a touch-up, you know, maybe they've just gotten their lawn or they've been taking good care of it, and maybe they're even in an environment where the lawn is flourishing because of the soil that's underneath and all that sort of good stuff, when do these people put down fertilizer?
It would be, we would start at the end of April, beginning of May, depending on the temperature. And we fertilize, what we recommend is fertilize at least 6-7 times a year because our seasons have become a little bit longer. So we recommend three at least fertilizations in the summer, I mean, sorry, in the spring, and 3 or 4 in the fall. Usually in the spring it's about every 3 weeks, and in the fall about once a month, finishing off around about the middle or end of November, just before the snow flies.
And I think I've heard you say this numerous times when I've been around the office and hear you talking to, you know, clients, less is more, right, Mommy Alexander?
Exactly. We recommend only, well, using what we use here, because it is a bit high in nitrogen, we recommend small doses, 3 pounds per 1,000 square feet. And like I say, every 3 weeks, because if you put down a big dose, you're losing it into the soil, and it's not helping the soil.
Okay.
So,
and just a question too. What, you know, you talked about doing it in the spring and then in the fall. Can you explain why you're not putting fertilizer down in the summer months?
Because it's going to burn your grass, especially. I mean, if you put down an organic fertilizer, it might not affect the lawns. You know, but if you're using something with, you know, like a 24/7/15 or 21/7/10 or something like that, it's not going to, because the lawns need to become dormant in the hot weather. So you don't want to activate them at all at that time.
Okay. And then, you know, again, coming into summer, you know, we're marching through spring and the grass is starting to grow now. When do you recommend that people, you know, do that first, you know, mowing of the lawn? Because I think everybody's anxious to smell that grass being cut. But when do you do it, Mom?
Usually we're waiting till the grass has a chance to grow. So at least it should be, probably between 2.5, 3, they start cutting. And we suggest they keep their lawns around 2 inches in the spring, and then during the you know, hot weather, they should leave it at about 3 inches. And then when we get to fall, probably around the end of September, we bring it back down to about 2 inches, especially before the season ends. We don't want it to be too high so that the mice and moles and everything come and hide there for winter.
Okay. Oh, I never even thought about that. Good for you, Mommy Alexander, all over that. So thank you so much. Is there any sort of final advice that you would give to, you know, antsy spring lawn gardeners who want to get out there and do stuff?
I would definitely suggest that every lawn owner who wants to keep his grass in good shape, be sure you put some lime down at least once a year, preferably twice. If a small dose, if you're on clay, or in the fall, you know, we always suggest early spring or August, September. That's a good time to put down your lime. With, you know, you put down the lime and then you put the fertilizer right after, and it works together. It's super.
Fantastic. Mommy Alexander, you're a rock star.
My pleasure.
Well, before I let you go, again, thank you so much for hanging out on the show. And I can't wait to have you back on. And I actually already mentioned last week that recently it was my birthday, and you were sweet enough to make me another birthday cake, as you usually do. And was this experience okay? I don't think I stressed you out too much with this one.
Not at all. You were there. I mean, we even managed to get the icing almost to perfection. Right?
I know. I know. It was exciting. And we made headphones. We made headphones this year for my birthday, which was fantastic. Mommy Alexander, thanks so much for hanging out. Have a good day.
Yeah, and you too.
That's Mommy Alexander right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Bring on the remix.
By Moto Blanco right here on the Kelly Alexander Show. Well, can't believe another 60 minutes has come and gone. A huge thank you going out to my guests, Joe Yonan, Stéphane Grandin, Mommy Alexander, and Gina Lee of The Love Zone. And always want to leave you in a positive frame of mind for the week ahead. So here is your positive quote of the week from Confucius. The will to win, the desire to succeed, the urge to reach your full potential. These are the keys that will unlock the door to personal excellence. There you go. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.